what's the point of BDS? Yeah. Brand Israel has been an enormous hit. He carried in a whole load of mice and he released them into McDonald's.
Starbucks, for example. I mean, that's the number one on our list.
When we're going after Starbucks in, let's say, the Middle East, the big loser there is actually probably a local Muslim.
I think it was the CEO of Pure Gym who made some outrageous remarks.
The Muslims are all ordering Iron Brew and not ordering Coke. You chip away at the edifice that is Brand Israel.
Israel is far more important to the global economic system, to the liberal world order, to America's interests abroad. Are the Israelis afraid of BDS?
Absolutely.
The boycott, divestment and sanctions movement, BDS, is gaining currency as the heinous slaughter of Gaza continues. Many in the Muslim community have lists of companies that should be avoided, and even apps have been designed to make it easy. But the sheer breadth of companies to boycott, the dizzying amounts of brands and the confusion over lists makes the whole process quite tricky. Then there's the issue of burnout. Should we instead focus on the worst offenders? How effective are individual efforts when countries East and West continue multi-billion dollar trade with Israel? To help us navigate this difficult topic, we have with us today Ibrahim Khan. Ibrahim is currently the CEO of Islamic Finance Guru and its sister company, Curate Capital. He holds a BA in philosophy, politics and economics from the University of Oxford, an Al-Amir degree from As-Salam Institute and an MA in Islamic Finance. Prior to setting up Islamic Finance Guru, Ibrahim was a corporate lawyer. Ibrahim Khan, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah and welcome to The Thinking Muslim.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Jalal, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's so wonderful to have you with us, actually. And I know that the subject of BDS is a very confusing subject for me. I must say, I have found it bewildering, some of the lists that have gone round. And I often walk into a shop and someone who's accompanying me says, you can't go into there. And I have to say, I'm quite dumbfounded sometimes with just the sheer amount of information that's out there. So I would like you, and I know you're the right person to talk to about this, I would like you to demystify this world, but also to explain to me the impact BDS is having on the real world. Now, let's start with BDS as a concept, as a basic idea. Break it down for me. What does it stand for? What's it about?
Yeah, so BDS is a movement that has been going for several decades now. And over the last, I'd say, 15, 20 years has picked up a lot of steam. So you've got essentially three stages. And the ultimate goal is that we want peace in Palestine, or we want there to be international law, you know, established in that territory. Hmm. And in order for us to get there, the first move is boycott. So you say, we are not going to buy certain products. We're not going to take the services of certain companies. The next stage after that is, once that has built up a head of steam, you say, and we're not also going to invest, because it's a little bit harder, right? Because when you're investing, it's you're going to have to log in, you're going to have to do something, you're going to have to write letters. So it's a little bit more commitment. Yeah. So the next stage is divestment. So we're not going to invest in these companies who we think are bad, and we can talk about what bad looks like. Mm. And then the final thing is, because of all the hullabaloo that's been created, because of all the mood music that's now been set, there is also sanctions. And sanctions is not something that an individual can do. It has to be government. Mm. And that's when, realistically, a state like Israel, which is really difficult to get in line, that's when it would potentially start listening. Mm. But in order to get to that stage, we are going to need to start with just boycotting and then divestments. And then that creates a pressure for sanctions.
So are we at, that's fascinating, because I've never understood this to be stages, so that I've learned something already. What stage are we at as a global community that are conscious of what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinians?
So we're at the stage of boycott and divestments. Mm. And really, when we think about sanctions, we're really talking about either United Nations, but particularly a country like the USA, because that's going to have a real impact on Israel.
Yeah.
And so we're at this kind of stage. But the other thing to think about here, Jalal, is like, what's the point of BDS? Yeah. Because is it really about hurting Israel economically, or is it something else? And I would argue that if you just look at the maths, if you look at where the money flows into Israel and where they're exporting to, the vast majority of those countries are not Muslim majority countries. They're countries like Europe, especially mainland Europe, America. You'll have some people like Japan in there as well, Korea, and you'll have other countries like that.
Yeah.
It doesn't really have that many economic ties, at least, you know, deep economic ties with the Middle East when you just look at the numbers.
Nice.
So if the question is, you know, are we going to hurt Israel economically? It's very difficult, I think, for us to say, yeah, we're going to do that by boycotting. Mm-hmm. And if you even look at the composition of the Israeli economy, a big chunk of it is the diamond trade. Mm-hmm. A big chunk of it is technology. The big consumers of these industries are not necessarily, you know, Muslim majority. So I think the actual real impact, and I'm obviously a big advocate of BDS, and you might think, well, why is that if there's no economic benefit?
Yeah.
The critical thing with BDS is that it creates this aura around Israel that Israel is a persona non grata. You're not, you don't want to go anywhere near this thing. And that's the critical thing here that we're trying to create.
All right, so that's really interesting. So you're saying our individual boycotts may have an impact, an economic impact, but they're not going to be a substantial enough impact to really harm the Israeli economy. So that's not the aim behind BDS. The aim is more political. We want to isolate, like maybe during South African apartheid, isolate the state and make it a pariah state and make it feel like it no longer has friends and allies internationally. If we were to set that as an aim, how much do you think BDS, or how far has BDS been successful in achieving that so far?
So the short answer is I think it's unprecedented in terms of success over the last 6 to 9 months. I think we have seen a sea change, and I think from a position of brand Israel, there's been an enormous hit to that brand, and it's never going to be the same again. But if you take the South African example, I think it's really interesting. So the South African example, you had people like OPEC. They put an embargo on South Africa. Mm. And then you had the United Nations General Assembly. They put some sanctions on South Africa. Yeah. And then eventually you had America putting some light sanctions on South Africa as well. But one of the critical moves here was actually that this whole vibe around South Africa spooked some of the big financiers of South Africa.
Right.
And they said, guys, we're just not going to renew your loan. So you're going to have to find somewhere else. And that whenever we're talking about money and finances and loans, that's major because it has a very leveraged effect on the entire economy, on the entire country.
Right.
And that then started this cascade. And it's hard to say, you know, that, you know, this was definitely the reason why South Africa ultimately ended up, you know, becoming what it is today or not, but it definitely had a big effect. And so coming back to modern day and where Israel is today and how we're thinking about boycotting, the way I think about it for myself personally is, sure, we should think about, okay, what's the most high impact stuff that we can do that's really going to hurt Israel? Fine, let's do that. But then also let's keep an eye on what's going to create the most amount of noise as well. So for me personally, I think, okay, I am a user of a lot of tech, so I'm going to be really careful about that. So companies like Monday.com or Fiverr, I'm very conscious, or Intel, I'm very conscious and aware that I try and avoid those as much as I can.
Yeah.
And then you've got the other side of, and then you've got the banks.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is another absolutely vital area for us to focus on, because banks are very apolitical, at least ostensibly quite apolitical, and they really don't like bad press. But then you have banks like Barclays and HSBC and a number of other major banks are financing companies like Booking.com, Expedia. They're financing Bank Leumi, which is a bank in Israel that has branches in occupied territories.
Yeah.
And HSBC is financing that bank to flourish in Israel and occupied territories.
Right.
Now, we are indirect supporters of that, because the way that the banking system works is that you and I have money in a bank account, and then that money is used at some in some way, shape, or form by whichever bank it is to make these loans out to whoever they want to do that to.
Yeah.
So but when we decide and we send a signal to someone like HSBC or you know whoever the bank might be, that guys, we're no longer going to bank with you because we don't like this financing that you're doing. The financing alone is probably not you know that big a deal, but the signal it sends to the overall financial industry is massive,
right.
Because then it becomes like investing in fossil fuels. So there's a reason why right now all of the fossil fuel companies in the world are actually really good value for money, because everyone is so conscious about ESG and being ethical that we don't want to touch fossil fuels. That's what you want to create around Israeli companies as well and the Israeli economy as a whole.
So when you talk about these companies you've just listed, Monday.com or Booking, these are Israeli companies, right?
No.
Ah.
So this is again where it gets very complex.
Yeah.
So there are companies within, I guess there's three flavors of how you might do BDS when it comes to companies specifically.
Yeah.
The first flavor is to say that we are only going to boycott companies that are active in illegal occupied territories or in some kind of illegality.
Yes.
So, for example, we are going to boycott Elbit Systems, which is a big arms manufacturer that is out of Israel.
Yeah.
Or we're going to boycott people who make drones that are being used by the military for war crimes.
Yes.
Or we're going to boycott someone like Airbnb or Expedia or Booking.com. Because if you go on their websites, they are advertising for sites and hotels in occupied territories.
Right.
And so that would be, you know, that's just a complete contravention of international law.
Sure.
So that would be the first and I think very uncontroversial kind of boycott that you can have.
Yeah.
And the UN itself has actually listed out companies in official UN guidelines that these are the guys that are contravening our you know guidelines on this.
Yeah.
Then you've got a broader group of companies, and this is all Israeli tax-paying companies.
Yes.
And so this is, and I think here you can have a bit of a judgment call because there might be Arab-Israeli companies in there as well, owned by Palestinians, which are paying taxes to Israel, but actually, you know, you would want to support them if you can.
Yes.
So you have to use a bit of a judgment here. But then there are, and it's also how deep you want to go. So some companies, they are quite neutral. They're quite out of politics. And then there's other companies that are very actively donating towards the IDF and getting quite involved. And from memory now, I think Fiverr.com, when I looked into it, the CEO was pretty active and, you know, was quite leaning in on this.
Yes.
So it's going into that level of detail sometimes. For someone like me, I think that's fine to do. Mm. I'll give you an easy solution for someone who isn't nerdy like me as well in a second.
Yeah.
And then the final approach to boycott, which is where I think sadly we as a Muslim community are, maybe not sadly, but it's we are going to boycott anything that vaguely offends our sensibilities and we feel that it's somehow standing for Israel or standing for America or imperialism, and therefore we're going to go after that.
Yes.
So companies like, let's say, for example, McDonald's or Starbucks whatever the company might be, there's loads of them that suddenly pop up and everyone's now going after them. And I remember my favorite video over the last, I guess, 6 to 9 months was where this brother, I presume he was a brother anyway, he carried in a whole load of mice, colored mice, and he released them into McDonald's.
Yes.
And he kept on doing it around all these McDonald's branches all over Birmingham.
Yes.
And so that to keep on shutting it down because of mice infestations.
Yeah.
So there's that third, I think, much more scattergun, chaotic kind of boycott as well.
Yeah.
And so taking a step back, right? So what should we practically do when we're thinking about boycotting? Well, I think it's actually really simple. So what we should do is we should sit down and think, okay, what are the big lists out there? So there's Boycott Witness News, I think is the URL. I can share it with you afterwards.
Yes, please.
And there's Palestine Solidarity Campaign. They've got some list of companies. So you have a look at the list of those companies and you no need to be overwhelmed. Just look at those lists of companies and think, okay, which are the ones that I actually use quite regularly? And that's going to be really obvious because you use them. So you can just make a list of those companies. Okay, so I can't use them. I need to come up with alternatives.
Yeah.
That's really easy and simple. And that's where I think the vast bulk of people can have a decent impact. Mm-hmm. Then the second thing that we can do, and you know, I laugh at people who boycott McDonald's or you know, Coke or possibly Pure Gym, but actually I do it myself.
Yes.
And the reason why I do it is because, as we talked about initially, the economic aspect of this boycott is actually marginal.
Negligible, yeah.
You want to jump on the hype with BDS and really make it, you know, make it go viral.
Yes.
Because that's actually impact. Like students in Colombia, across the world, they've created this entire movement saying, our universities need to divest from these companies.
Yeah.
The reality is this divestment is not going to move, you know, the needle at all economically.
Yeah.
But it has the effect that we're seeing. And that's what we want to create.
Right. So I'm going to come back to it because you burst a few of my bubbles. And as I said, I don't pay very much attention to the granular detail here. Someone has to tell me, and it's usually a young person that says, you can't go into this shop and you can go into that shop. And I just obey diligently. So you're saying to me that Starbucks, for example, I mean, that's the number one on our list, it seems to me. The idea of boycotting Starbucks probably features quite low down in your list of offending brands when it comes to isolating Israel. If I said that in a accurate, I mean, I get the point about, sure. Look, it adds to the conversation about boycott, and that's a plus. But in terms of actually creating reputational or economic damage, it probably doesn't do very much.
Yeah, the case of Starbucks is an interesting one because there are a few lenses to look at it. Mm. So the first is that the biggest shareholder of Starbucks is actually very Zionist.
Okay.
And by hurting Starbucks, you do ultimately affect him.
Yes.
And obviously we don't necessarily agree with his views. But that is a little bit tangential from, you know, where we started from.
Right.
And then the second interesting tidbit about Starbucks and a lot of these big corporates is that they themselves are franchising businesses.
Yes.
And so they've sold a franchise, let's say, to the Middle East, or they've sold a franchise to the UK. And the franchise owner is actually getting the majority of the economics. And maybe the franchise might get 10, 15% of the profits out of it. And so when we are affecting, or when we're going after Starbucks in, let's say, the Middle East, the big loser there is actually probably a local Muslim somewhere.
Yeah.
But I still think that we should do it. And I think we should do it for two reasons. The first is because of the hullabaloo point, because it just sends a massive signal. Mm. The next Starbucks or Costa or Pret or whoever it might be thinks 15 times before they do anything particularly silly.
Yeah.
And that is exactly what you want to create. And then the second reason is because, even sure, it might be affecting that franchisor in the Middle East or wherever it might be, and they're almost like a bit of a victim here. Mm-hmm. But what it does is it means that the next time the Starbucks franchise is just not that appealing, because people know that, all right, the next time anything happens in, you know, the Israel-Palestine conflict, well, I'm going to take a hit. And so you make it just less appealing as a brand.
Yeah.
And I think that ultimately does affect the main company, which is problematic because it's been quite supportive in many ways.
And the same goes for Coke or Pepsi or any of these American brands who may have had they may have done something silly at the beginning or during the crisis. Or for example, yesterday on Question Time, there was I think it was the CEO of Pure Gym who made some outrageous remarks about defending the fact that Israel has a right to self-defense. And that's just created a head of steam on social media. And now we have a call for a general boycott of Pure Gym. So where does that, just so I'm clear, where does that fit into your schema about effectiveness?
Definitely jump onto it.
Yeah.
So the schema of effectiveness is do your own personal BDS personal finance checklist and boycott certain companies and create a different lifestyle, right? If you're a big user of certain, let's say Starbucks, or you're a big user of certain technology, you've found an alternative, you stick to that. And then after that, just keep your eyes open. And wherever there's hype, wherever there's some young, you know, technology savvy person who says, don't go into that store, don't do it.
Yeah.
And that create, wherever there's a dinner, party, and you might have Muslims, non-Muslims there,
yeah.
and the Muslims are all ordering iron brew and not ordering Coke.
Because of Scotland.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
That has an effect yes. because then people realize, actually, hang on, you know, this is pretty serious. And it just, you know, again, it just kind of, you chip away yes. at the edifice that is brand Israel.
Right. Okay. So in summary, if I've understood you, boycotts, divestment has an impact in isolating Israel politically, and it creates a global public opinion that makes Israel a pariah state. And so the more we do that, the more we pick on those brands that are the worst offenders or medium offenders or even possibly not great offenders, but who defend Israel in a particular way, or whose CEOs defend Israel in a particular way, the more we contribute to this political impact. But economically, at least at this level, we're not going to have that much of an impact on Israel. Is that's where we are here?
I think that's fair.
Yeah.
Obviously, we shouldn't go after companies without cause, because that obviously would be unfair on those companies and it's harmful. But I think in the main,
yeah.
our community hasn't gone after companies that are completely yeah. blameless.
Yeah.
They typically have had some kind of link that yeah. is problematic. And the other reason why jumping onto the bandwagon is so good
yes.
is because with BDS, you don't want to try and boil the ocean.
Mm.
You want to try and be as specific as you can be
yeah.
So that you send a message to that company
right.
that it actually affects their share price, it actually affects their bottom line,
yeah.
and that then results in action.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, if you're trying to boycott everyone and anything without any coordination around it, it can actually not really have any impact. Oh, and the critical thing, Jalal, that everyone should do if they are boycotting
yeah.
is communicate to those companies as
right.
well.
Right, I was going to ask you that. So you've got to tell them you're not going to be using their product or associating yourself with their brand because of what they've said about Palestine.
Exactly. Because if we don't do that,
yeah.
we don't give them the feedback
right.
that they shouldn't have done that.
Right.
They're then kind of sat there scratching their head, wondering, okay, why is it slightly yeah. down? Why is our profit slightly down?
Right.
But if we give them that feedback, and there's a thousand people who give them that feedback,
yeah.
that does have an impact.
Fantastic. Okay, so tell me about what we're seeing in the States, and of course also here in the UK with these encampments and the call to divest from Israeli companies or arms manufacturers that provide the bombs for Israel. Because having in our initial conversation, you said that even that, because that seems a bit more substantial to me than me not drinking my decaf latte at Starbucks, which I used to do once upon a time, I'm afraid. You're suggesting that even that side isn't necessarily that impactful from an economic lens, at least. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. Of course, it's more impactful because yeah. we're normally then talking about millions of pounds, if not tens of millions of pounds.
Yeah.
But it is again going back to the same point about creating a vibe. Right. And what I mean by that is when it comes to the world of investments.
Yeah.
So let's say you put a lot of pressure on, I don't know, Birmingham University or Oxford University, and they agree that they're going to divest from Lockheed Martin. They're going to divest from any Israeli companies that they might have direct exposure to and the other companies that have been asked to be divested from.
Yes.
That alone financially is going to affect the share price of those companies a little bit. And that's then ultimately going to percolate down to those, to the shareholders of those companies.
Yeah.
So there's some benefit there,
yeah.
but it's not frankly material.
Really?
It's not going to move the needle. But what is going to move the needle is the signal that, all right, Oxford University has divested, Cambridge has divested, this has divested, that has divested.
Yeah.
And then it creates the same effect that I mentioned about ESG.
Yeah.
So, you've got this environmental and social governance movement
yeah.
where we're all very, climate friendly, and we don't want to be investing in sin industries anymore
yeah.
and all of that.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, you have this mass extrication of capital from companies just on the basis of a rule and just on the basis of, you know, we're learning from our investors or we're learning from our clients that we really shouldn't be going down. It's just not worth the headache. Yeah. So we're now just going to set the rule to do something else. And I can hear these conversations happening now in funds and fund managers out there, where even if they're, you know, not particularly bothered about the political situation, they want to remain unbothered by the political situation. Right. And that means that if they know that some of their investors will get a bit upset about, you know, if they're going to invest in, let's say, an Israeli company, or they're going to do something like that, they will just, that then starts featuring into their decision making. And that is what's really important, because at a some level, if you now abstract away and away again, that goes into the really large pools of capital. And when those large pools of capital start taking those viewpoints, then you have a sea change. So that, again, with ESG, it started off with climate activists saying, we're not going to invest in certain companies. And then they lobbied and lobbied and lobbied, and they made it a bit of a movement. And then they had larger people, charities, NGOs, universities.
Pension funds.
Not necessarily pension funds immediately. Yeah. So you had these organizations with a bit more of a point of view.
Right.
They went early and they started divesting. Mm-hmm. And then you had the pension funds. Right. And then it became a good thing. And then everyone started doing it. Right. And then everyone's being asking that, you know, if you're a fund manager, are you ESG compliant? And then everyone jumps on the bandwagon, and then it becomes normal.
Yes.
So that's where we are. So we're, you know, when we as individuals, we divest, that's really vital. When we put pressure on our organizations to divest, that's really vital. Probably not economically significant, but then it balloons out very quickly.
Okay, so that's wonderful. So in a sense, we are suggesting that everything helps, and it does contribute to this political isolation of Israel. I want to ask more of a fundamental question about boycotts, because often I do come across the odd Muslim who says to me that boycotts just don't work. And they don't mean, you know, you're going to run out of steam and you're going to get, but rather they've sort of said half of what you've said and suggest that even the political side, Israel is a different type of state than, say, South Africa is or was. South Africa was an apartheid state, but of course it was pretty low down the list of states that America and Europe were interested in. Israel is far more important to the global economic system, to the liberal world order, to America's interests abroad. And so the ability to isolate Israel is going to be far more trickier by consumers and even, you know, universities and medium to large organizations. But how would you respond to that?
I think it's a really valid point.
Yeah.
And I think we are at the micro level when we've been talking about BDS at the micro level.
Yeah.
When you take a step back and you apply a very realist lens of politics, and you just think of the world as very Machiavellian, and actually international law doesn't really matter. And if you think about an explanatory hypothesis of the world, and that being power, and where power lies is ultimately they get their way, as being quite a helpful explanation of the world, then you need to think about, okay, well, economics and all of this conversation around money ultimately boils back down to power. So what is actually the real way that we can, you know, move these levers of power economically? And I think there you have to look at where trade is happening, where are these big flows of money, and also where's the money sitting? Where does it ultimately go and settle?
Yes.
Because that's also hugely influential. And when it comes to trade, it's all about populations, and it's about governments, and, you know, the larger countries typically have a lot of sway because of that. But then you have the tech companies, and you have some of the most technologically advanced and most valuable companies in the world. That's where the value goes and resides. That's where the money ends up sitting. You have companies like Nvidia that have gone, you know, skyrocketed because of the rise of artificial intelligence and the use of the chips that they make. And so where do we then sit as a Muslim community vis-a-vis this? Right now, we're seeing the world with a different lens.
Yes.
So when we see the world with a different lens, what we realize is that we as individuals need to do two things at the very minimum. The first is anyone with any ounce of entrepreneurial spirit in them needs to become an entrepreneur. And they should try multiple times. And if they enjoy it, they should stick at it. If they don't, then obviously they can go down other paths.
Yes.
And I'll go back to why I think this is so important in a second.
Yeah.
The second thing that everyone can do is make sure that their investments are going into A, halal things, but B, impactful things, and C, and this is really crucial, into Muslim countries and Muslim economies. Mm-hmm. Because right now what happens when we're talking about, you know, where does this money settle? It flows and then it settles. What happens is your money or my money, Jalal, is usually in some kind of pension fund, a lot of it, is in some kind of investment. And we have these Islamic funds out there. HSBC has one, which perhaps we should be boycotting.
Yeah.
HSBC has this Islamic fund, but in it, there are company, most of it is in the USA. And so your money, hard-earned money, is going and helping prop up SpaceX, Microsoft, Tesla. And these are the same companies that then are growing the American economy and also potentially helping Israel out in various ways and means as well. Yeah. So what we need to do is, rather than thinking, okay, this is halal, we actually need to think this is halal, and we need to be looping that money back into the Middle East, Southeast Asia, India, Pakistan maybe, right? And other, and our own communities, our own Muslim founders and Muslim entrepreneurs. And that's the way that we get this virtuous cycle, this circular economy going. Yeah. And you know, we talk about Islamic funds. Mm-hmm. And the Islamic funds, we have to have this compromised position of a 30% debt to asset ratio.
Right.
We allow 30% haram riba in a company because there just aren't enough, if any, companies out there that are purely Sharia compliant with no conventional leverage in there.
Yes.
And we have to have this compromise. But why is that, right? We don't think take a step back and think in the Islamic finance industry, why is that?
Yeah.
The reason why that is because we haven't created our own companies to get to that level where they are publicly listed and we can then invest in them. Now, if you look at the top 200 companies in the world, there's only about two that are from Muslim countries.
Yeah.
The first of them is Aramco. The second of them is SABIC, which is an offshoot of Aramco. And that's just because of oil.
Yes.
So we're just nowhere to be seen on the entrepreneurial problem-solving end of the spectrum. Right. And so coming back to the entrepreneurship point, and also your question at the start. Mm. So when about power and how Israel is so embedded into the infrastructure of the world, entrepreneurship, when we boil it back down, what is it? It's solving problems, pressing problems that the world has and wrapping it around a way that makes money and a way that sustains that organization and, you know, coagulates good people around it. And then it solves that particular problem.
Yeah.
And that's really valuable for society, Muslims and non-Muslims, everyone. And the more valuable you become, the more hard to lose, irreplaceable you become. And Israel, like it or not, has had created a lot of value in the world. And it has become very hard to extricate ourselves from Israel because of the value it's created. So really, the long-term answer is creating our own value and really investing in entrepreneurship and taking those big swings. Because that's the other thing. There's different forms of entrepreneurship that can be done as well.
Yeah.
There's a bread-and-butter entrepreneurship where we create a small business here or there. As a community, we need to have real big ambitions to try and create enormous businesses, because that's when you can really move the needle.
Right. Okay. And sanctions. So in your earlier answer, you talked about how we don't actually have great flows of money between and trade between the Muslim world and Israel in comparison to the Western world and Israel. Until now, I've read so many social media tweets that are encouraging and in fact calling upon Muslim countries like Turkey, who have recently shut down trade, although there's some dispute about how much they've shut down, but shut down trade with Israel. But if I was to extrapolate or your answer, your suggestion is that Even if they do that, economically, it's not going to have that much impact on Israel. But maybe politically, it does. Is that a fair?
Correct.
Yeah,
I think that's exactly correct.
Yeah,
I think if you think about where you look at countries like South Korea. South Korea, after World War, World War II, was roughly the same economic position as North Korea.
Right.
But South Korea invested in technology. Israel was not a particularly wealthy country. It didn't even exist, right? And then it's become a top 25 country in the world.
Yeah.
Germany massively recovered after the war. And there's multiple other examples. And each of these countries, they accumulated this power and accumulated this defensibility on the political stage because of their investments into technology. And so, when we think about our Muslim countries, they need to be doing exactly, and frankly, Turkey is actually doing a pretty good job of that. It's investing a lot into technology, yeah, and it has some significant, globally significant companies in certain sectors, at least, that are doing good stuff. That's, from an economic perspective, actually probably their most material contribution, even though it's not obvious to the eye.
How about, I mean, this is more of a political discussion or an argument, but Turkey's argument thus far, I mean, it recently changed its policy towards its thinking towards trade with Israel. But until now, its argument was that if it does that in isolation of other Muslim countries, then in a sense, the hit on Turkey will be greater. I mean, do you buy that argument? Is there an argument to say that if the Muslim world doesn't work in a coordinated fashion, then not only will it be diffused, but potentially these countries could be isolated by the United States and her allies?
Yeah, I think that's true.
Yeah.
But I think that is one of the great tragedies of our ummah, right? Where we have this, you've got the prisoner's dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
This is a game theory concept,
yeah,
where if everyone acts together effectively, then together you can actually have a much bigger outcome and a much, yeah, better outcome. But if everyone's divided, then actually it becomes, you know, worse for everyone.
Yeah.
I think this is where, at the local level, as individuals, we sometimes find this even right now, where with all of the the strong views and emotions around politics, we might disagree with people, but we must stick together, mm-hmm, as much as possible, because that's the real value here.
Yes.
And the same goes on the international stage, because when you start working together, mm-hmm, when you start having an ummah or a Middle East or a Southeast Asia,
yes,
that's actually working together, it's really hard to compete against. I mean, look at the European Union. It's very powerful as a result of coming together, despite the fact that they've been fighting with each other for centuries.
Yes.
So I think we need to get towards that unity and that coordination.
Now, back to the boycott divestment stages. You've said that you've explained the scheme, and it makes a lot of sense and why we do it. But of course, sometimes we may have an impact on the behavior of an individual company. I can imagine Pure Gym, for example, may issue a statement in the coming days saying that their CEO spoke out of line, or it was misunderstood, and tried to regain some reputation, or even may make comments that are more in favor of our thinking and the way our mindset when it comes to Israel. I mean, how conceivable do you think that strategy is when, because I can imagine today there have been thousands of people that are in Britain that have torn up or have stopped their direct debit to this particular gym. Is that an intended outcome from the BDS movement?
I think it's Pure Gym obviously wasn't on the list.
No.
until today.
Yesterday, yeah.
And I think it goes back to the point around the hullabaloo point,
mm,
because I think it is good that Pure Gym are going to be held to account,
yes,
for something their CEO did. And I'm sure the way out they will probably come back with is, mm, they're going to make a donation towards some kind of charity in Palestine, right, and possibly one in Israel as well.
Yeah.
And apologize at some level for what they did.
Yeah.
I think it's good,
yeah,
that happens, because then the next time, mm, another CEO thinks multiple times before saying something silly.
Right, that's good. Very good. How about visiting Palestine? And again, I've heard on some social media channels that when you visit a country like Palestine, of course, the Israelis are going to be the net benefactors of your tourism and your serving their economy. And so there is a call to not, for outsiders not to visit Palestine. Work me through, how would you think, like, the logic of that? Does that make sense in your mind?
I'm genuinely quite split on it, because I know when we were talking about this, how many scholars say that you should go to Palestine.
Yeah.
And they say that you should support the economy of the Palestinians. Yeah. They rely on your spending and also to raise awareness politically of the plight of the Palestinians. So it brings eyeballs onto what's going on.
Yeah.
All of which I think is fair. I think given that I'm very financially or economically minded, I think that the net beneficiary of, I think, 70% of your economic spend when you go to Israel-Palestine will likely be Israel. Really? Because the big spend will be, you know, flights, a lot of transport, a lot of infrastructure.
Yeah.
All of that is going to be going to Israeli companies. And so I would say that the net benefit economically is probably on the Israeli side.
Yeah.
But you could argue that actually that's fine, because it's not going to be a massive net benefit on the Israeli side.
Yeah.
And as long as you do very significant advocacy as a result of that, it's a net loss.
Yes.
Like if you go away and you say, guys, okay, we want you to be boycotting this, this, and this,
yeah,
actually even economically you can kind of, it's like carbon offsetting, but Israel benefit offsetting, if that makes sense.
And when it comes to boycotts, of course, boycott is a very passive thing to do in a way. And of course, you tell the company, but there are some who suggest that we should engage in direct action. We should stage sit-ins in shops that are have very close ties with Israel, who are these offenders, big or small. Is that something that you feel adds to that hullabaloo you talked about, that weight of public opinion to isolate Israel? Is that a positive thing, in other words, to engage in direct action?
It definitely does, I think, contribute to the hullabaloo. Yeah. I
suppose the environmental movement would employ that tactic. Yes.
Yeah. I think with our responses, you have certain people who are just naturally inclined to that stuff.
Yeah.
Then you have certain people who are just a lot more, I don't know, genteel and like timid and kind, right? So they would probably never do that.
Yes.
So you've got that spectrum. Now, just thinking about it just very, neutrally, it does have an impact. And the suffragettes, when they were chaining themselves to railings and throwing themselves in front of horses, it definitely did have an impact. We're talking about them to this day. And the Palestinian activists who got Elbit Systems, I think Elbit Systems has effectively left the UK now,
really?
From a, you know, just the presence in the UK, because they just keep on getting harassed.
Yeah.
So it does have an impact. Obviously, it's, you know, it is technically illegal what they're doing, and this then gets into very interesting philosophical territory around, you know, when is civil disobedience morally and ethically justified?
Yes.
I think that's a very interesting question. Yeah. I'm interested to hear your views on that as well.
I need to think about it. But I mean, I think that you're completely right. Politically, it has an impact. It gets into the news and people talk about it. So, you know, it does contribute quite overtly to the isolating of Israel. And I think that's probably a positive thing, especially at this stage where they're committing such horrendous crimes. Are the Israelis afraid of BDS?
Absolutely. I mean, this is one of the top three priorities,
really,
that Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu have actively stated, really, that they care about. And the other two are the Iranian nuclear threat and Hamas and Hezbollah. So it's up there with how much they care about it.
Really?
And they care about it so much because they're getting so much support from America and Europe, and that's what's propping up this Israeli colonialist endeavor.
Yeah.
And If you look at what's happening with the Jewish community in America and even in Europe, for the first time, you've got all these young Jewish students coming through who just don't buy in to the Israeli narrative anymore. And that is really scary. If there's anything that's worried Benjamin Netanyahu and Israel the most, it is this, because this is now the horse is bolting. You can't really pull this back, because the next generation is going to be even more anti-Israel, because they're going to be even more distant to Israel. Yeah. And all of this is actually created by the broader narrative and the broader sounds and mood music that is being created by things like BDS and the political activism. Because if you think about it, Israel, the Jewish Zionist population, obviously not all of the Jews are Zionists, but that population is not necessarily growing as fast as the Arab population in that territory. Yeah. And so they're reliant on two things. They're reliant on a lot of immigration still happening, and they're reliant on the people, the Zionists in America, lobbying and getting Israel the money that it needs to continue with its endeavor in Israel. Yeah. And if both of those things are put under massive threat because of BDS, that's a big concern. And you can see that financially. So the AIPAC and some of the Israel lobby in America, they offered, I think it was 20 million or 25 million to a politician to run against Rashida Tlaib, who's a Palestinian politician in America. These are crazy sums of money. They've spent around $70 or $80 million over the last year supporting their candidates to make sure that they have their people in the Senate, in Congress.
Right.
And you can see the results of that, where we have this bizarre situation where actually now the world opinion is completely against Israel, and actually a bulk of the Democratic opinion is against Israel as well. And yet the US politicians pass a bill that says that if you criticize this foreign state, that's effectively akin to anti-Semitism. It's like, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever unless there's money changing hands, and there is.
How do we avoid the fatigue that comes with a lot of this type of activism? You and I have been having discussions about the Muslim vote, sort of political side to, I suppose, isolating Israel and her allies in the West, these political parties, Labour and Conservative. And I think we come up against an argument in the Muslim community that a lot of this is short-lived. You know, after the Iraq war, there was a first to boycott products from America, but that only lasted a year or two, and we went back to normal. I mean, how do we deal with that inevitable sluggishness that seeps in to the Muslim community once an issue becomes less relevant or important or less in the news and media?
I think there's probably two points. One is that if we create a different lifestyle, we create a lifestyle change. You know, when they talk about losing weight, they say that you have to create a lifestyle change. It's the same thing with BDS. So rather than using, let's say, Tesco or a certain type of yogurt product that is problematic, you switch from that to this other product, right? So all these the Muslim takeaways, just because of sheer dirty looks and pressure on them, have a lot of them have switched away from Diet Coke and Coca-Cola and are now stocking Iron Brew Bar Cola and other things like that. So once you create a different supply chain, a different narrative, then I think you can stick to it. That's the first point.
Yeah.
And the second point is that at some level, it doesn't really worry me too much, because businesses and enterprises are just reflecting the ebbs and flows of ideas and politics and power and money. And sure, once a certain issue dies down, it might be that it isn't, as salient, right, to necessarily boycott McDonald's, because McDonald's or whoever the case, whichever that organization might be, is simply just a reflection of all of the people that are either its shareholders or the people therein. And so that's who we're ultimately trying to influence. And it might just not be as salient to be influencing them as vociferously as at other times. And I'm kind of happy with that. I don't think we should go against human nature too much in that way either.
Maybe one final question. I'm not sure if you have an answer to this question, but what is the Sharia position on boycotting? I mean, is there, do you know of scholars who've talked about this, and is there an obligation perhaps to boycott a company or a product that comes from Israel if we can show that it comes directly from Israel and it's serving the Israeli state? I mean, how do we understand the hukm shari'i regarding this matter?
So I don't necessarily want to give a fatwa on this, but certain scholars have.
Really?
And they've said that on the basis that Israeli land, particularly in occupied territories, is stolen land.
Yes.
And many would say actually big chunks of Israel is stolen land.
Yes.
Then anything that is grown on there and any enterprises that are flourishing on there are effectively stolen goods. So it would be impermissible for us to knowingly then go and consume those. Mm. So that's where the haram designation does come for this. Now, in terms of boycott as a whole and where the Sharia sits on that, Friends of Al-Aqsa, I think Ismail Patel, have done some work around this, and I would refer people to them.
Yes.
And you can check out some of the analysis that they've presented on this. Yeah. But my understanding is that there have been incidents throughout time where in our history and in our seerah, in our traditions, effectively boycotts have taken place because of the views and because of the behaviors of certain individuals.
Because surely that, for a big segment of the, a large segment of the Muslim community, the halal haram argument will have a lot of sway over their lifestyle choices and their attitudes towards these products. I mean, I was told a few years back, maybe 10 years back, by someone that, you know, boycotting an Israeli product is fard, and to take, to consume that product is haram. So it was a scholar who said that to me. And so I consciously would check, you know, the vegetable that I buy from the supermarket to make sure it's not labeled Israel, because I have in my mind it's a halal and haram rubric. I mean, I would suggest, and I suspect most people, a lot of people, will be affected by that argument. I mean, what's your take on that?
I think it will probably have a very visceral effect when it comes to food.
Yes.
Because we really...
halal and haram is our big thing.
We really
thing.
Care
yes.
about that.
Yes.
Which is odd, because we should have the same visceral effect when it comes to our banking or our software provider or the choice of our phone.
Yes.
But I think in that sense, I think it is a good thing to be encouraging.
Yes.
Regardless, you know, for the Muslim community, they should be aware of this.
Yeah.
And even if, with this kind of stuff, I'm pretty relaxed. I mean, I'm relaxed a lot of the time when I take a very, you know, I feel like...
You don't drink a lot of Coke, it seems.
I feel like we sometimes make Islam and the Sharia too hard for ourselves.
Yes.
And Islam hasn't come to make things difficult. So when it comes to these things, I'm quite happy to let things run. Like, if someone has that worry about this could be haram or halal, and it might not, you know, you can make academic, you know, scholarly arguments that perhaps it's not haram. It's okay. Just the fact that there is a question mark and the net loser in this situation is going to be Israel, I'm quite happy with that. Mm-hmm. And we don't need to necessarily, you know, worry ourselves too much. And if there's a hadith, right, where if there is al-halalu bayyin wal-haramu bayyin wa baynahuma mushtabihatun la ya'lamuha kathiran minan nas. So there are things that are ambiguous between the haram and the halal, and the best people just avoid those things. So even if we think that this is in that territory, we should just avoid it.
Ibrahim Khan, I think this has been a fascinating conversation. Jazakallah khair. Thank you very much for your time today.
Barakallah fiqh. It's been a pleasure.
Please remember to subscribe to our social media and YouTube channels, and head over to our website thinkinmuslim.com to sign up to my weekly newsletter. Jazakallah khair.